Shipley. Here on FM, our Book of the Week, on Silbury Hill. In 1970, after a peripatetic early childhood, Adam Thorpe found himself transplanted into the primitive tribalism of a public school, an education paid for by his father's employer as compensation for foreign postings. The dubious privilege of being sent away at the age of 13 was tempered by the power of the ancient landscape in which he found himself. The reader is Philip Franks.
My junior house at Marlborough College was designed by a Victorian builder of prisons. It was 3 floors high, a lumpen cube of brooding red brick, with a deep central well descending vertiginously to the basement. This void was skirted round on each floor by railed-off galleries, with dormitories instead of cells. Our initiation ceremony would apparently involve crossing the void hand over hand on a knotted rope of bedsheets. Back in the late 19th century, a knot had come undone, and a new boy had plunged to his death and now haunted the basement as a pale apparition. He had left a faint discoloration on the basement's stone floor, like the bare chalk on Dragon Hill. Looking up at the third floor level high above, I wondered whether he had had time to scream, whether he had known what was happening in those few seconds of fall. These questions were especially riveting when you were on lock-up duty, alone in the basement at night, switching off the lights one by one behind you, your torch wavering over the discoloration. He'd been seen standing there, or his scream had been heard. "It's definitely planned for tomorrow night," a particularly eager boy in our dorm regularly reassured us from out of the darkness. The relief when I learned from a gentle giant in the year above that we had, ho-ho, been had, felt like the lifting of a death sentence. Maybe the whole tragic account was itself just a sadistic myth. Years later, I learned that it wasn't. During my gap year, my parents had come back from Africa to a hamlet at the foot of the Berkshire Downs. A neighbour turned out to be an old Marlburian, and at some point during a village gathering, he told me that his father had been holding one end of the sheet when that poor boy fell to his death in A House. What? Oh, yes. He made an awful racket as he went. The worst, though, was when he hit. Legend was suddenly converted into concrete fact. What had seemed misty and far off now felt too close. I was holding on to a rope of knotted sheets called time and could feel the tremors and twitches of the past. It was a kind of recovered memory. The dorm where I spent my first night as a boarder looked directly out on a steep, overgrown slope full of trees and bushes. This was one side of Merlin's Mound, or simply the Mound. Merlin was buried in it, thus the name. It too was haunted by the wizard himself. But that was not the reason it was strictly forbidden to climb it. Theoretically, it was an ancient monument, though a much neglected one, with a Victorian water tank occupying the top and a crumbling 18th century grotto in its flank, doubling as a bike shed. I was startled, looking out of the window into the blackness, to hear voices from the steep foliage, to see red pinprick eyes winking and blinking, until a sharp whiff of tobacco explained it. Most of the other boys had been boarding since the age of 7 or earlier. They knew the codes and had grown inured to a lack of affection. They had, in a way, gone tribal without the blood kinship of a true tribe. For those pupils with what might be called manipulative personality disorder, boarding school is an open field 24/7, and liberal-minded Marlborough College in the 1970s was peculiarly open. One sixth form boy in the grim senior house I went up to in my second year, let's call him Philip, had lost his father in an accident. His greasy elbow-length hair and a tendency to sadistic manipulation were genially tolerated. He was, in fact, given carte blanche. Although I had firmly refused his sexual advances, I had to perform two tasks that some might see as substitution, or, if not, then for some deeper maternal or paternal lack. Washing his hair and telling him bedtime stories. Every 3 weeks or so, he would lie back in one of the cast-iron claw-footed bathtubs lined up in our common bathroom, with its long row of basins, its communal showers and loos without locks, and I would knead his pulpy, slippery mane. Every 3 days or so, I had to entertain him and the entire dorm, after lights out, with improvised stories, delivered while sitting on the edge of his bed like, well, a father. If he wasn't sufficiently entertained, I was punished in various ways familiar to professional torturers. His thumb and forefinger once held my right nipple in a vice for at least 2 minutes, leaving a livid aureole that lasted most of the term. I can still see his face as he squeezed, his eyes seeking mine with a gleeful determination full, I suppose, of rage against the fate that had snatched his dad. By keeping to ghosts, humour, and general suspense, I mostly jammed my way out of punishment. My chief tormentor was a dark-haired, squat boy of inordinate strength, malignity, and wealth. He delighted in calling me Mr. Average, and would sidle up with a stage villain cackle in class and prophesy various unpleasant things that were to happen to me that night. I could dig a tunnel into this darkness, this great mound of oblivion, the blind marl of the unsaid heaped up and now grassed over after decades, and reveal deeper horrors that I have learned about since. But why disturb? No digging. Climbing forbidden. My only physical means of escape was, of course, to venture into the immediate countryside. It was my bicycle, or grid in the curious school argo, that took me deepest into the landscape's open airiness. I have a vivid memory of sitting up on the downs, among electric blue sheets of bluebells on a day of sun, blissfully alone, just where the smooth trunks of the beeches petered out into a grassy expanse, munching on the snack I'd brought in my pannier and thinking I was in heaven. If only life could be this alone, and not the other. I never went very far, but I went far enough to feel, in my early teens, a kind of Shropshire lad solitariness, a roaming freedom. I was constructing something separate and independent through a love of landscape, animals, trees, and clean skies that was forming, I suppose, my adult personality. And then there was the prehistoric. Tumuli lumped on the crests or crouched in the woods. The tunnel darkness of the long barrows. The enigmatic humanoid suggestion of the upright sarsens. This all slightly frightened me, at least in the first 2 years. Louis MacNeice, another Mulburian, seemed to have felt the same way. Here in the first inhabited heights of chalk, I could feel my mind crumble and dry like a fossil sponge. I could feel my body curl like a fetus and the rind of a barrow harden round me to reveal millennia hence some inkling of the ways of man before he invented plough or wheel. He has it exactly. Your psyche is altered by this area, he says. This is because, as a teenager, you are relatively new to existence. Attending boarding school for 5 years, in the middle of what was our island's greatest sacred land temple, affects the process of assimilating the mystery of why you are here at all. One wintry Sunday, when I was about 15, three of us went off on our grids to treasure hunt in East Kennet Longbarrow, the neglected sibling of the celebrated West Kennet version. Stranded in a field, East Kennet had no public access and was unexcavated. More mystery. Forbidden territory. The essential ingredients for boyish adventure. The barrow, shrouded entirely in bushes and trees, was enormous. We crouched by its protruding sarsens at one end, trying to conjure ghosts from the shivery damp. No ghosts came, but instead I had an extraordinary sense of my own mortality. I had never really understood it before, not in my stripling bones, But now they were feeling it as chill fact. I was a mere blip, soon to be extinguished, in comparison with the multiple generations witnessed by this earthwork and those stretching out into the future. This was possibly my earliest conscious realization that death was woven into the landscape here in the Chalklands in a colossally evident way. In the neglected cupboard drawers of A House basement, I had found team photographs dating from the Edwardian period. There was one of the house rugby team in 1910. Two rows of boys, aged 13 or 14, the perfect age for the trenches when war broke. I would stare at those photos mounted on card, those confident, sporty faces, wondering how many had survived. Oddly, it never occurred to me to see if their names were carved into the great curving inner wall of the Memorial Hall, built in 1925 as a monumental reminder of the 749 old boys prematurely killed by the war. The hall was part of the school's very own death complex, being connected to the chapel by a stone walkway and including a pool of remembrance, now a flowerbed. Like a stone circle, the whole place seemed thronged with phantoms. It was in the Mem Hall, in my third term, that I heard about the death of a new friend. The master announced that a serious accident had taken place on the weekend outward bound trip to Snowdon. Timothy, who sat next to me in French, was both clever and nice, his kind smile and civilized words beginning to brighten my days. I had had lunch with him and another friend just before he had set off for the coach in his orange cagoule. Now I was sitting among the entire school population, 800 living beings, including many I feared or detested, hearing about his death. He had fallen off the mountain. What was additionally shocking for me, however, was that several of the boys around me were sniggering. Timothy's surname lent itself to a morbid pun. I felt I was trapped in a house of horrors. That moment has left me with a residue, not just of grief, but of fear. Fear of my fellow human beings. That human beings can, given the right circumstances, an absence of love, say, entirely lack compassion or feeling. No rituals, no ceremonies, no memorials, no vigils, no flowers, no poems, no counselors, no nothing. Just the empty desk, the unoccupied bed, his belongings ushered away to join him in oblivion. I learned about the details from those who had been on the expedition. Timothy had somehow stumbled off the path and slid down a glacier while walking up the mountain with the others. Although the sports teacher had yelled at him to use his ice axe, he'd kept knocking the ice with the handle instead of the blade. Then he had vanished from sight over a 600-foot precipice. Had there been a fatal moment of horseplay near the edge? Tim was at the back of the group. The teacher was leading from the front. Vertiginous drops attract boys. They pretend to push each other over, dare one another. One cheery scuffle, boots skidding on the ice. Something, anyway, had gone wrong. Tim losing his balance. The gentle slope of the glacier taking him on its sheer slipperiness, slowly to the 600-foot drop. As the others watched disbelieving, and the young sports teacher yelled. And I'm still yelling with him. Yelling into the fierce cold and the wind.
Philip Franks was reading from On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. Over on Radio 4 Extra this week, Richard Hammond reads from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Flies Again by Frank Cottrell Boyce, the tale of a family who attempt to rebuild an old camper van with the famous flying car's engine.
Dad peered inside. Look at this gorgeous old steering wheel and the old-fashioned gauges. I bet the horn sounds like a choir. He honked the horn and the front bumper fell off and broke into pieces on the pavement. Nothing that can't be fixed, said Dad. Look, it's got the classic split windscreen. It looks like two big eyes. When you see it from a distance, it's like a big smiley face.
Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Flies Again, part of this week's 4 o'clock show over on BBC Radio 4 Extra.